Here's a little multiple choice question for you. Pick the right answer, and you may end up more wealthy in the long run. Stock pickers are often compared to A. Chimpanzees throwing darts at the stock page, B. someone looking for a needle in a haystack, C. gamblers at the roulette table, D. tax generators for the government, E. jesters playing a shell game with investors' money, or F. all of the above. Coming up on the Mad Money Machine Show 54 for mid-March, Wall Street analyst turned passive investing evangelist Henry Blodgett joins me, and I ask him, what do you really think about Jim Cramer? Also coming up, step 3 in the 12-step program for active investors, stock pickers. And Mark Hebner will have the answer to the question, what is the efficient frontier? Then I'll tell you about an April 1st trick you can play on your active trading friends. All that and more on the Mad Money Machine. The Mad Money Machine is proud to be sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. Why? Because I believe they've got a portfolio that can match your risk capacity. Take their risk capacity survey and contact one of their advisors to help you now. Okay, you've probably heard that stocks return something like, 10% on average annually over the past history of stocks? Well, now John Bogle thinks that stocks will only return 7% a year for the next decade, which makes all those pesky little fees charged by your mutual funds all the more significant, doesn't it? Now, out of 10%, maybe didn't seem like that was too painful, although it really is. Out of 7% is painful. That same fee is now a larger percentage of the return that you're expecting to get. So what do you got to do? You got to get into low-cost index funds that set it and forget it, have a very low turnover ratio, and try to get every bit of that return for yourself. And speaking of Bogle, I'm sure you're familiar with the Vanguard Diehards Forum at diehards.org. Well, they've got a new system up and running that they're trying to migrate to, and I encourage you to take a look at it at diehards.org. It's a new Vanguard Diehards Forum website. It's the same software I use in my forums. Of course, they have many, many, many more users and members of that list, which makes it much more valuable. And I don't want to discourage you from coming out to the MadMoneyMachine.com forum and having discussions about this show or about all things Cramer. And one more little thing that I want to pass on to you that's been helpful for me. When I went to that podcasting expo out in California last September, one of the vendors there was Shield Zone. It makes an invisible shield. It's a plastic protecting covering for your iPod or for your electronic gadgets. And I bought one of those coverings for my wife's iPod that I broke last month on rollerblading. I never put it on her iPod because her iPod was already scratched up. So this new iPod I bought, I put that invisible shield on it, and it still looks like brand new. You can just wipe it off. It takes just a little bit of effort to install it on your iPod, and it looks like a mirror finish both on the front and the back. I recommend you take a look at shieldzone.com. This plastic protecting, it costs about $20, $25. Hello, I'm Buffett Warrington. We'll get you back to Federation Curling on ESPN right after this update to the now rain-soaked 85th Annual Madman Machine Match Play Golf Classic. We're here at the final round of this matchup between the Cramer-influenced average portfolios and the IFA Index Folio 100, who is now wearing a bright red waterproof golf suit. That's right. What had started out as a beautiful day here at the Cotswolds Hertfordshire New Willisham has suddenly gotten ugly. Dark clouds have erupted, and Mother Nature's vengeance has been cast upon us all. Joining me here is Graham Benjaminson. Graham, the tournament officials have, shockingly, not suspended play. The crowd has mostly gotten in their cars. Can you make sense of any of this for us?
Yes, Buffett. The officials here at the court with Servish and Wilsham are saying play on, even in this drenching downpour. The Kramer portfolios, sadly, do not bring waterproof gear, exhibiting 100% faith in our forecasters at his own peril.
Right. As poor as these weather predictions are, can you imagine those poor suckers trying to predict the stock market?
Oh, please don't remind me about my stocks.
Sorry, Graham. Well, one of the officials has gone to the utility shed to get Kramer's portfolio some garbage bags to wear. It's quite a sight seeing him swing that club with all that plastic on. Well, after the par 4 third hole on which Index Folio birdied and Kramer Portfolio's bogeyed after hitting that tree off his errant drive, the heavens opened and both players took a rain-soaked double bogey on the par 4 fourth hole. Their shots knocked down by the strong winds and stuck in the mud on impact. Then both players stepped up to this par 4 fifth hole. It's got what used to be a small creek running down the left sides now turned into sort of a whitewater rapids. Graham, what's happening out there?
Index Folio's ball is buried dead center in the fairway about 20 yards behind where the Kramer Portfolio's ball is landed. More about that in a moment. He'll have to take a pretty hard swing to get it out of there. Not bad. Moving on towards the hole. He'll be about 50 yards short for his third shot.
I'm surprised he got any club on that thing at all, being buried about halfway down in the mud. Okay, now tell us, where's that Kramer ball?
The Kramer Portfolio's ball splashed once in the fairway and came to rest just on the edge of the water along the left-hand side. He has wrapped those plastic bags around both feet as he is standing now in that swollen creek attempting to hit this ball. It's an awkward lie, awkward stance, and awkward swing. I can't see him moving this thing much more than 10 yards. Let's watch and see. Oh my. He's moved it about 2 feet away, Buffett. Well, he did not lose his turn to play. He'll have about 120 yards to the green, where the squeegee team is frantically working to try to make it playable surface.
Well, we'll see if he can get it there on his next shot. After four holes, Index Folio 100 leads the Kramer Portfolios by about 2%. For Graham Benjaminson, this is Buffett Warrington. Now back to our weekend marathon coverage of Federation Curling on ESPN. If you've been with the Mad Money Machine for any length of time, you've probably heard the 12 Steps for Active Investors, where I did sort of a musical interpretation of each of the 12 steps. And if you haven't, you can go out to madmoneymachine.com and click on the 12 Steps tab at the top, and that'll take you to a page where you can listen to each of the 12 steps, or you can listen to all of them in one big long program. Well, guess what? Mark Hebner at IFA liked that so much, he's going to include that on a 4-CD set that he's going to give away, which includes his podcasts and other information for investors. Well, as you can imagine, getting the rights from all 12 artists was a painful process for him, I'm sure. Most artists were very happy to be included on the CD. Three were not. And so, I redid three of them. Step 2, Step 11, and Step 12. And I thought you might like to hear the new Step 2.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. A 12-step program for active investors. Step 2, Nobel Laureates. My name is Paul, and I'm an active investor.
I sit at my computer, my active trading software. Some days are better than others. Some never end. Now, the academics tell me that by doing this, that in the end, I'm going to be out. My returns will be lower. Not me, man. I'm the active investor. I'm going to live on, die young. I'm living for today. I want to know what my returns are. I want to see all my stocks at a glance. And with my market-beating returns, I'm going to dance till I drop. I don't want to be told by any school teacher how my portfolio won't grow old with me. I'm the active investor. I always want to be on top.
So in the end, you're going to be out. You're going to stay low. You're going to be away. You're going to live hard. You're going to die young. You're going to live for today. You want to know now. You want to see all. You want to dance till you drop. Don't want
wanna be tall, they wanna get old. Always wanna be on top. Always wanna be on top. Always wanna be on top.
In 1900, Louis Bachelier's doctoral thesis said there is no useful information contained in historical price movements of securities. In 1933, Alfred Coles reviewed about 12,000 stock recommendations and published his results in an article entitled, "Can Stock Market Forecasters Forecast?" His conclusion, it is doubtful. Nobel Prize in Economics winner Harry Markowitz presented the theory of the efficient portfolio. Modigliani and Miller showed that a firm's value is unrelated to its dividend policy, and that policy is an unreliable guide for stock selection. William Sharpe, another Nobel Prize in Economics winner, said that the capital asset pricing model finds that the expected return of an asset is determined by its beta coefficient, a means of measuring the volatility of a security or portfolio of securities in comparison with the market as a whole. Paul Samuelson, another Nobel Prize in Economics winner, said that market prices are the best estimates of value. Price changes follow random patterns, and future stock prices are unpredictable. Eugene Fama's efficient market theory concluded that no one can consistently outperform a market. Then he, along with Kenneth French, developed the three-factor asset pricing model as an invaluable tool for asset allocation and portfolio analysis. If you're not aware of the works of these distinguished academics, if your only knowledge of the stock market is what the TV or newspaper tell you, we're here to rescue you. We're here to bring you home.
Is there somewhere you can rescue me? Somewhere you can bring me home again? Somewhere.
Well, I'd like to take a moment to personally thank all of the artists then that agreed to allow IFA to use their music on that CD. John Zielman and the Selves had agreed already, and then when I needed a new song for step two, I went to them, and because they're so helpful, and that's their song, Always Want to Be on Top. I want to thank Di Sheldon in the same way. She had agreed, and then when I needed a new song for step 12, I picked up What in the World, which I'll play for you in an upcoming show, or you can go hear it for yourself out at the website. I want to especially thank Zach and Sarah, because their music is used in each one of the 12 steps as the ending part, Rescue Me. If they hadn't agreed, I would have been in deep doo-doo. And all of the other artists are listed at that 12-step page. Thank you so much. And since we're on the subject of the 12 steps, I'd like to go ahead and play a snippet for you now of Mark's own podcast about step 3, stock pickers. You gotta just come to accept it. Stock pickers do not beat the market. The main factor influencing the success of a stock picker is simple luck. You know, there have been a number of studies that show only about 3% of stock pickers beat their benchmarks. Most stock pickers, what they do is they invest in stocks that have done well recently, I guess trend followers. But those same stocks usually do poorly for those investors. You got to realize, the performance of stocks is random, just like the news that influences their prices. So it's not possible to consistently pick stocks that will be top performers in the future. So Mark, with that definition of a stock picker, what does that mean in terms of how the individuals or institutions that fall under that definition usually fare?
Well, the data has shown that they fare very poorly. The amazing statistic is that over periods of like 10 years or so, about 97% of these stock pickers end up underperforming a simple buy and hold S&P 500 index fund. How could this be? How could we have this entire industry where managers are paid $2 to $3 million a year to manage people's money and only about 3% of them end up doing better? There's a number of studies, but there's just a simple one just requested by Morningstar by a little journalist out of a Twin Cities newspaper where they just called up and said, you know, tell me over the last 10 years what's happened among mutual fund managers. And they looked at almost 1,500 mutual fund managers. And at the end of the period, only 35 of them ended up with a return in excess of the S&P 500. There are study after study after study, and they're all documented in my book and on our website, that virtually ended up with the same conclusion. Sometimes it's 2.5%, sometimes it's 3.5%, sometimes it's 5%, but they're all very small. And if you think about the unlikelihood of you knowing who those winners will be at the beginning of the period, it really starts to come home to you as to how difficult this process would be for you to pick a winner.
Why is it that stock pickers fail then?
They fail primarily because they don't have the knowledge about what tomorrow's news story will be. And ironically, people say, well, the market's fixed. There's all kinds of people with inside information. The question is do you look good in orange? Martha Stewart learned a little bit about this, trading on inside information. But the real irony of Martha's story is that she ended up being wrong about her inside information. So even people who think they have some edge really end up not having an edge at all.
So step three is about advising the Mad Money Machine listeners on the dangers and miscalculations of stock pickers. And now we know why they fail. But what are some of their misguided strategies on investing?
Well, when people look at stocks, I guess they're looking at an infinite number of strategies as to how and why to pick them. You know, I guess one of the most common strategies is they look at the analysts' reports and what the analysts happen to be recommending that particular day. But as we learned in the dot-com crash, the analysts weren't really independent. They were just pushing the stocks that the investment bankers at the other side of the brokerage firm wanted them to push. And so there's a number of strategies that are designed to get you to trade in what I like to call the really big casino, that being the stock market, and they're really there to generate fees and commissions for this industry and not to help investors at all.
Okay, so the million-dollar question then is, what's the alternative to stock picking?
It is a million-dollar question. In fact, for me, it was a $30 million question. It's unbelievable. If you've been an investor for 10 years or more and you look back at the results of your investments over that period and you benchmark them to a reasonable benchmark, you will also discover what it has cost you not to be investing in just a simple portfolio of index funds. We now have a tool on IFA.com that allows you to look at benchmarks over any period of time going all the way back to 1927, and this is an eye-opener for all investors who get an opportunity to look. What you will ultimately discover is that rather than digging through the haystack looking for the needle, you'd be far better off just to buy the haystack and walk away.
Well, I know I'm convinced. Having followed the stock advice on TV, I hope you'll get a copy of Mark's book, Index Funds, the 12-Step Program for Active Investors, before you do any stock picking or buy into mutual funds or managers that do stock picking on your behalf. So Henry Blodgett is a former Wall Street stock analyst and now passive investing evangelist and author of the Wall Street Self-Defense Manual, a consumer's guide to intelligent investing. He edits an award-winning business blog, The Internet Outsider, and is a frequent contributor to Slate, Newsweek International, and The New York Times, among other publications. From 1994 through 2001, Henry worked in corporate finance and equity research at Prudential Securities, Oppenheimer & Company, Merrill Lynch, where he specialized in the software and internet sectors. In 2000, Henry was voted the number one internet e-commerce analyst on Wall Street by Institutional Investor, Greenwich Associates, and TheStreet.com. And was one of the most widely followed analysts in the world. In 2002, after leaving Wall Street, Henry was named in a wide-ranging regulatory investigation about conflict of interest between brokerage firm research and banking functions. He participated in the global settlement and is now precluded from working in the industry. Henry earned a BA from Yale, and I am pleased to have Henry Blodgett join me on the Mad Money Machine. So I was going to ask you, what are you doing these days? But I can tell you are indeed busy with a number of websites. You've got InternetOutsider.com. You've got WallStreetSelfDefenseManual.com and the book. And you've got a column at Slate called Bad Advice. And, of course, you're the president of Cherry Hill Research. So are you doing anything else?
Well, first of all, let me say thank you for having me on the show. I think your site, from what I've read, is excellent, and it's a pleasure to do this, so thank you. I think you listed it. I'm working on a bunch of things. I'm also developing a new blog that'll be focused on investing. The current one that you mentioned, Wall Street Self-Defense, is definitely related to the book, so hopefully the new blog will allow me to talk about just different topics in investing in a lot more detail without relating it to the book.
Well, and talking about the book, I have read it a couple times now, and you know, I think it really has one of the clearest explanations of why passive investing is best. What motivated you to write this book?
Well, first, say thanks. I mean, thank you. If it had done that, then it's definitely set out to do one of the things that I was aiming for, because I think that the distinction between passive and active and the distinction between trading and investing is something that even people who are very much experts in the business miss, and I think it's something that one really has to step back and understand the difference. But I think it's an easy distinction to miss, but it's absolutely critical that people understand it, especially if they are to actually embrace the idea that passive investing is intelligent as opposed to settling for mediocrity, which a lot of people who don't know what they're talking about think. Certainly, when I was on Wall Street, I obviously saw not only the way people invest from the institutional side and so forth, but saw a huge amount of media. I was working on Wall Street in a time when the stock market became sort of a national pastime, and I watched the media cover that. And I think what I was struck by was the gulf of understanding between Wall Street and between the media, and how the media often portrays what goes on Wall Street to investors. And I just wanted to simplify as much as I could concepts that are pretty complex and ultimately have teams of academics doing incredibly detailed research on pieces of them, but just simplify the concepts so that people really understood what Wall Street can do for you, which is some things, and what it definitely cannot do for you, and ultimately what to look out for. And hopefully the book does that.
At that time, back in those times, were you an active investor?
I wasn't active in the sense that I was trading frequently. It's just I've never been a particularly active trader because I don't think it's a smart way to invest, and it just doesn't fit my personality. But I was buying and holding stocks, and I actually still have some stocks that I owned in that period that I still own, and I own them as much for sentimental purposes as anything else. I'm not thinking I'm going to beat the market or what have you. But to the extent that I was buying individual stocks as opposed to just passive funds, I did do some active investing, yes.
And at that time, what did you think of passive investing and of index funds?
I think that I was certainly aware of the indexing movement, and I was aware of John Bogle and others who had written about it intelligently. I didn't realize until I left Wall Street and really took a look at the industry as a whole and the actual performance records of mutual funds versus passive funds, I didn't realize until then just how much the odds favor passive and just how dangerous active investing is to most people who pursue it. I, again, had the sense that index funds were a smart way to go, but I didn't realize how overwhelming the odds were that it was a smarter strategy for everybody. So that's something that I came to by doing a lot of research after I left Wall Street.
So that was the conversion process, is really after leaving Wall Street.
I wouldn't. It's funny. A lot of people have said this is sort of a conversion. I think that being an analyst on Wall Street and speaking primarily to active investors and then being an investor on the outside, I don't think the two are necessarily mutually exclusive. You still have trillions of dollars and many, many mutual funds and other companies that are pursuing active management, whether or not that's the smartest strategy. And Wall Street exists in large part to serve that community. And so I would say it's just what I have had is a different perspective now that I'm off Wall Street and I look at the whole business from the perspective of the smartest way for an individual to invest, which I just think that's very different mm-hmm. than the way the media generally portrays it or the way people off Wall Street normally think of as, quote, smart investing.
Yeah. Now, if CNBC was a channel for individual investors that was the best possible message that they could get out, what would it look like?
That's a tough question. I think that one has to bear in mind that CNBC is a business, and ultimately CNBC will fail unless it makes smart business decisions. And it turns out that when one is trying to program a television-based investing channel, the way to make the best business decisions is to focus on the market on a minute-by-minute basis and have lots of prognostication and lots of opinions and lots of experts. And CNBC, I think, does a superb job of that. It's very difficult not to watch, and it's always interesting, I find. But from the perspective of an individual who does not want to be a day trader and is trying to give themselves the best odds of the highest rate of return over the long haul, CNBC should probably be turned off. And what would it look like if it were actually catering to people and trying to encourage them to invest as intelligently as possible? Ultimately, I think it would talk a lot about the advantages of passive investing. It would use a lot of the academic research that's been done. It would be far less personality driven. It would be far less focused on what the market was doing. But in CNBC's defense, all of that would be a death knell for CNBC as a television channel, and everybody there would be fired, and the company would probably go out of business. So
exactly.
It's no mystery why CNBC is focused on what it is. And again, if one is trading actively or works on Wall Street, it's great entertainment, and it's often very informative and interesting.
And thus, the reason the Mad Money Machine podcast does not have 1 million subscribers, I say.
Probably the case. It's harder to make a living in the media on passive investing, for sure.
Why doesn't your book have an index?
Index meaning just a list of topics at the end?
Right.
I don't even know. I didn't really even think about it. I figured the notes would be enough.
So. I wanted to look up Cramer, for example, and see if he was mentioned in the book or look
he
up.
He's not in it.
Yeah, I can tell. I can see that, you know, having said there's no index, I did go into Amazon and search inside the book, acts as my index in that sense.
Oh, so, that's good.
Yeah, did a search for Cramer, and you're right. He's not in there. Why not?
I think that I've obviously had some exchanges indirectly with Jim since writing the book, and I wrote a couple of columns about the whole Mad Money show and what Jim's doing now and so forth on Slate since then. But I just, in the book, I was very much interested in focusing on concepts and mm-hmm. then using those concepts as a way, taking some examples as a way of illustrating those concepts, but I tried not to focus on specific individuals or what have you.
Okay, okay. And I think it makes sense for your book to live a good long time on the shelves is to not get caught up in too many fads. So I wish you had written these columns 1.5 years ago when I was becoming obsessed with Mad Money. Not that I would have listened, but for anyone who hasn't really read the articles yet out at slate.com, and I'll have a link to it at madmoneymachine.com in the show notes of this show. Here's an open-ended question. What do you really think about Jim Cramer?
Well, I think Jim is an amazing entertainer. I have always been impressed with the breadth of his knowledge, the ability to talk about almost any topic market-related under the sun. He's phenomenally impressive in that way. I think, as I argued in the Slate articles, anyone who thinks that the overall strategy and advice that he gives is intelligent investing for an individual is likely to be incredibly disappointed. And I just think that, again, when you step back and you look at the performance of professionals who do this all day long and nothing but, and yet you still have at least 4 out of 5 of them underperforming an unmanaged index, and then you take the next step, which is that an individual who is watching a TV show in the evening and gathering some stock picks or stock advice from that and then going out and doing a little bit of research on the side is at an extreme disadvantage to hedge funds and mutual funds and other professionals, and there are tens of thousands of them who do this 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And one of the strongest messages that I would have for any individual is just you have to do everything possible not to fall for this idea that with an E-Trade account and a Yahoo Finance page and a little bit of CNBC, that you are actually making choices that are informed relative to the professionals you are competing against. And so I think that if the idea is that Jim is going to help give you an edge that you can then use to beat the professionals who do this all day long, I just think that is a huge recipe for disappointment.
Well, I loved that chapter in your book talking about who are we up against? Who is your competition? And you talk about in an analogy, sitting at the poker table, and you might be the third best player at the poker table, but you're still going to lose. Or
That's
talking
right.
about baseball players, and you're going up against professional athletes when you're trying to go out and hit a home run, and even the professional athletes get strikes, and really like the analogies in the book in that sense. But do you think Jim Cramer, after running a hedge fund and doing all this trading for 14 years, and is in this mindset of picking stocks, looking at companies, trying to trade and speculate on what's hot today, do you think he's even aware of the works of Markowitz, Fama, French, and these other great academics, and either chooses to ignore them or genuinely believes they're wrong? Or do you think that because he's obsessed with how companies and stocks perform, he's really just unaware of them? Because he's never had the need to absorb their ideas of the efficient frontier.
I don't know the answer to that, and I think I should probably talk generally just because I really don't know what Jim Cramer knows and what he doesn't about the academic research and whether he's really stepped back. I would say that generally, and I get this question a lot, is what do people on Wall Street in general think about indexing, and what do they think about the academic work and so forth? And I would say the general attitude is that academics don't get it, and yes, we understand that a minority of investors beat the market, and we are that minority. And everybody it tends to be overconfident. Obviously, there have been a lot of studies showing that 80% of people think that they're above average in driving, and 80% of kids in a class think they're going to finish in the top half of the class. People tend to be overconfident, and this is an area investing where it is extremely easy to be overconfident, primarily because when you decide to buy or sell a stock, you have a 50-50 chance of being correct. And those odds tend to fuel people's sense that they really have insight and so forth, and people don't tend to have the ability to really step back and say, well, I had 50-50 odds, and in fact, in a bull market, I had much better odds than that. So how much did I make versus what I would have made had I done nothing? So I think the answer is that most people on Wall Street, it's just not in their interest to step back and study the academic work. That's not what they're paid to do. And ultimately, I think they can always default. I'm sure Jim Cramer can always default to the idea that he is just telling people how it works, and this is a trading show. It's not an investing show, and certainly there's a defense for that. Again, I just think that the distinction that the average viewer should draw is that he is talking about trading and speculating, which is a negative sum game. If you do that, the expectation is that you will lose, versus investing, which has a positive sum game. If you invest and hold to the long haul, the expectation is that you will win. And I think that's a distinction that a lot of people miss.
Now, I have read in some of your blogs and even in your book that you have made the case that the stock market as a whole is currently overvalued. And I read this before last Tuesday's 416-point decline on the Dow. So are you once again a prophet, or how would you consider the stock market overvalued?
That's a good question. I think that the only method of valuing the stock market as a whole that stands up to rigorous analytical scrutiny is what is referred to as a cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio. And that is where an analyst is not simply taking the current year's earnings and taking the current market price and looking at that ratio, but is actually looking at the current year earnings in the context of the business cycle. So in other words, today we have record high profit margins. And if you just take a straight PE of the S&P 500, for example, it looks like it's about average for the century. But the reason it's average, in my opinion, is that the earnings are so incredibly strong right now. And if you actually go back to normalized earnings, so you take the middle of the range that earnings tend to migrate around, then the stock market looks extremely expensive. And it's been that way for years. And so I still think that making investment decisions and changing your investment strategy relative to what you think the market is going to do on a near-term basis is not intelligent because it's so hard to predict it. I do think that, and this is where I have not completely jumped into the passive camp, I do think that it makes sense to adjust your target asset allocations slightly based on whether the asset class that you're looking at is particularly expensive or particularly cheap. And I have not gotten to the point where I've found a lot of work that can really demonstrate that that is the most intelligent way to go. But I think certainly looking at a couple of centuries of asset class performance, it makes sense to say that we are still at this date trending around particular means. And when you get way above a particular mean, there's probably more risk and less upside than normal.
Well, I'll take the bait then and ask you, which particular asset classes now are overvalued or undervalued?
Well, that's unfortunately an extremely depressing question because basically what's happened in the last 5 to 10 years is that just about every major financial asset class has gotten bid up well beyond its historical mean. Mm. And certainly there are many people who think that it's different this time, that the old averages don't apply, and we're in a new world where the S&P average PE multiple is going to be, say, 20 as opposed to the 15 to 16 times we've always had. That is always possible. It's one of the hazards with ever trying to invest based on valuation. I tend to think that that's yet another example of people assuming that it's different because it's been a particular way for so long. But the bad news is that, unfortunately, most equities and most bonds are very historically expensive at this point. Not so much that one shouldn't have any money invested in them. I think at most what we're talking about is a small tweak of the asset allocation, but I think the only asset class that's not overpriced that is very easy to invest in right now is cash.
Yeah.
Cash is a very depressing thing to have to invest in. I wouldn't think that somebody who had an above normal cash allocation was being stupid. Put it that way.
What's next for you?
I think I want to continue to try to do what I've done in the book and what I'm doing a little bit in the blogs, and I hope to do more coming up and in the Slate articles, which is I think that it is basically act as an intermediary between Wall Street, the academic community, and individual investors. I think that given my experience on Wall Street and now several years of really getting deeply acquainted with a lot of the academic research, combined with the journalism that I've done, I feel like where I can help to bridge and help educate people is by really sitting in the middle and trying to take some of the concepts that really have been studied and proven in academia and make them very accessible to individuals. And similarly on Wall Street, my hope is that you will see more and more active managers over time really start to focus on the fact that what drives investment performance over the long haul is a reduction of costs and a reduction of expenses and less effort and money devoted to trying to beat the market and more devoted to things like the value effect and the small stock effect and others that have been shown to drive most of the market-beating returns over time. And so my hope is that there's a way to synthesize that and make it as interesting as it really is to people. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it would be nice to actually make it interesting from a television perspective as well. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize when you talk about indexing is that there are violent wars about the best way to construct an index fund and what is an index and what isn't, and the difference between an S&P index fund versus a Dimensional Fund Advisor's passive fund that's more of an actively managed index fund. And these are intentionally interesting controversies, and I think they're probably, I hope, is a way to make them accessible and interesting to average individual investors as well.
Well, what about a podcast?
You mean on Mad Money Machine?
No. I was asking. In fact, I would love that if you could come on my show and have a segment every show. But what about your own podcast?
It's an interesting idea. I think that's certainly one of the things I'll consider with the blog that I'm working on now, which is getting close. It should be in a week or two. I should be able to actually start publishing a little bit on there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, since we can't pick stocks, who do you like for American Idol this year?
I have made every effort after wasting countless hours with a couple of members in my household who very much enjoy the show. I've made every effort. In past years, I've wasted a lot of time, so I've made every effort to stay away from it this year. But I gather that somebody already has it locked up. At least that's what I read in the paper.
Oh, really? Really? Oh, boy.
I think there's a Jennifer Hudson like person who has been tipped to sweep it so far. So.
Okay, I hope you're talking about Melinda Doolittle. She's the one I wanted from the very beginning. So.
I don't know, but could be.
Well, thanks again. I thank you so very much. It's great to have you on here.
Thank you again for having me on the show, and best of luck with everything.
Well, I encourage you to check out his new blog at investmentintelligencer.com. I realize that's a lot of letters to type. But enter it in your favorites, bookmark it, and read it often. Now, in that segment, I mentioned something called the Efficient Frontier. And if you look at the very top of my website, where the banner is, it says Mad Money Machine, Exploring the Efficient Frontier to Find Financial Freedom. Now, I realize that not everybody's read Bernstein's books, and you might not know what the Efficient Frontier means. So I thought that would be a good subject for Mark Hebner to tackle in The Answer.
Staring you right in the face is the answer.
Mark, what is the Efficient Frontier?
Paul, the Efficient Frontier really helps investors identify how they can get their portfolio to the maximum expected return at a certain level of risk. If you go to the bottom of the IFA.com website, there's a graph down there that says risk-reward optimization. And that's what investing is really about. It's about optimizing your return at some level of risk. Now, this line sometimes is called the capital market line. It's an extension of the efficient frontier idea. The efficient frontier really has to do with the blending, in this case, of the equities and the bonds into two efficient portfolios. And then we've taken those and mixed them together to create this sort of opportunity set or continuum of risk and return that investors could choose from in trying to get the highest expected return for the risk level that's right for them.
There you have it. The answer.
Staring you right in the face is the answer.
Now, I know you've got a question about what's the best way to invest. Get it to me so that I can get it to Mark, so that he can get you the answer. So I mentioned at the very beginning an April 1st trick you can play on your active trading friends. Well, did you know that in addition to being April Fool's Day, April 1st is also Index Funds Day, and what you can do is you can go to indexfundsday.com, and you can put in your email address and the email address of friends that you want to send an e-card to, and here's what they get when they receive an email. It says, in my case, it would say, Paul Boyer has sent you an e-card.
And it says, April 1st, Index Funds Day, is the ideal time to draw attention to the differences between active investment management and indexing, and why it's a fool's game to think one can outperform the market averages. On this April Fool's Day, I thought you might want to review the site, indexfundsday.com, to learn about the You Can Beat the Market hoax. Visit indexfundsday.com to learn more, and also play the active management shell game. And this is, it's one of these flash games. If you click on that link and play this shell game, it brings up a jester who has three shells, and one of the balls under it is labeled market return. He's moving the shells around, but what you don't notice is that ball pops up onto his nose, and you're supposed to pick the shell that the market return is located underneath, and you pick one, and the first one says useless overhead. Second one I picked says manager turnover. The third one says survivorship bias. And you can play again. So none of the shells in the active management shell game make you a winner. Go check it out and send it to your active management friends. Well, I'd very much like to hear what you think about this or other shows that I've done. I appreciate your feedback, and there's a number of ways that you can get feedback to me. If you have a telephone, you can call 206-734-4763 and either leave a voicemail, or sometimes you can even catch me live online. You can email me at feedback@madmoneymachine.com. You can comment at the forums that I've set up at madmoneymachine.com. You can comment in the show notes of a show if you want to. In addition to getting me feedback, you can also sign up for the email newsletter system that I've set up. And like I mentioned on the previous show, I typically send out a little notice ahead of time of when I've posted a show, but I might use that for more urgent announcements as they come up. On the next Mad Money Machine, coming out March 27th, my top stock picks for the remainder of 2007, the best fund managers to entrust with your money, and 7 top tips for hedging with options. All that and more coming up on the Mad Money Machine, March 27th. Set your iTunes to download it on that day. This has been Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes stop that picking to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you on March 27th. And please do yourself a favor and point your browser to ifa.com, Index Funds Advisors. A little bit of investing intelligence can go a long way, and they've got a lot of intelligence out there.